Good day. Today is Thursday, 9th July 2026, and as you can see, I'm making this program from my hotel room in Montenegro, where I'm on holiday with my family, and where, of course, I'm attending a wedding of two very dear friends. And this is going to be a particularly busy day, so this is going to be an even shorter video, probably the shortest video that I'm going to make whilst I am here, for which apologies, but well, there it is. I don't go on holiday, as many of you have pointed out, very often. So, briefly, we now can see that we are in effect back in renewed conflict between the United States and Iran. The Iranians, some days ago, took action against a Saudi tanker that was trying to transit the Strait of Hormuz. There was a drone attack, apparently, on that tanker, and it received damage. It's always difficult to get a clear picture of what happened over the course of this incident, but the United States, President Trump, his officials, reacted very strongly to this event. One gets the sense that President Trump has been under a great deal of pressure ever since he signed the MOU about 3 weeks ago. And the situation escalated over the next couple of hours. There have been heavy strikes by the United States, strikes targeting Iranian cities, strikes on a much bigger scale than anything we have seen since the first announcement of a ceasefire between Iran and the United States back in April, at the beginning of April. The Iranians, for their part, have responded. They've resumed attacks on US bases across the Middle East. Iranian ballistic missiles have been launched. There have been more attacks, apparently, with Shahed and other types of Iranian drones. A lot of this is going on, taking place across the entire Middle East. And, well, I was reading just a few minutes ago, a short time ago, a short piece in the Iranian media which spoke of the Strait of Hormuz being closed for traffic again. And it looks as if we are in effect back where we were in March and April. The MOU, for the moment at least, is not operating. We have seen what looks like a complete breakdown of the ceasefire. And, well, it could be that we will be back in a state of full-scale war. Certainly, certain comments made by the President of the United States, by Donald Trump himself, might lead one to think so. Though with Trump, it's never clear that anything he says at any particular moment necessarily reflects long-term policy. He spoke about the war resuming, about the MOU being dead, but then he's also said that the Iranians are anxious for a deal and that he is in contact with their representatives and that negotiations are taking place. Things, by the way, that he used to say quite a lot during the fighting in March, when in fact there were no direct contacts between the Americans and the Iranians in the way that he said. And, well, with the closure of the Strait of Hormuz, the pressure on both sides is going to increase, but of course more immediately the pressure on President Trump and on the United States. President Trump himself admitted at the time that he signed the Memorandum of Understanding that the reason he did so was because he had been informed by the oil industry that there were only 4 weeks of usable reserves left, oil reserves left in the American inventory, and that after that point there would be a vertiginous rise in oil prices and in gasoline prices at the pumps, and that left him with no alternative but to sign the MOU. So that was the imperative. That was what pushed President Trump, by his own admission, to sign the MOU. Now, as Alex Cristoforo and I have discussed in many programs, the MOU, after it was signed, must have proved for the Iranians an enormous disappointment. To all appearances, the United States conceded all of Iran's demands. There were commitments to unfreeze Iranian assets, to lift sanctions, to repay funds to Iran, to pull US troops away from Iranian territory, to do many of the things that the Iranians wanted. And there were also commitments to start negotiations, to discuss Iran's enrichment program and other aspects of the dispute between Iran and the United States, and to achieve some kind of final settlement of all of these points of difference, all of these points of conflict between Iran and the United States within 60 days. And in return, the Iranians would loosen their grip on the Strait of Hormuz, and the United States would lift its sea blockade of Iran. Well, what actually happened was that the United States did lift its sea blockade on Iran, which did facilitate Iranian oil exports, and the Iranians did loosen their grip on the Strait of Hormuz. But this was the only part of the Memorandum of Understanding that was implemented. The Memorandum of Understanding required a ceasefire to be brought into effect in Lebanon. That never happened. Israel basically refused to agree to a ceasefire in Lebanon, so fighting there continued, and none of the many other things that the United States was required to do under the terms of the Memorandum of Understanding did it actually do. So far from there being negotiations lasting 60 days to agree the terms of a final settlement, there have been barely any negotiations at all. There was one meeting between the American and the Iranian negotiators. It made a certain amount of progress, but it certainly didn't achieve any decisive results such as the Iranians perhaps had hoped for. And in the meantime, oil prices fell, which of course is what the United States, what the Trump administration wanted to see happen. Some ships did successfully transit the Strait of Hormuz, and the Iranians gradually began to realize that what was actually happening was that their leverage over the United States, which principally comes from the fact that they have closed the Strait of Hormuz, or that they had closed the Strait of Hormuz, that leverage was slipping. I have explained how, whilst I was in Russia, I was told about Russian warnings to the Iranians that the Memorandum of Understanding was Iran's equivalent of the 2015 Minsk Agreement, that if the Iranians harbored any illusions that the terms of the Memorandum of Understanding would be honored, then they would be gravely mistaken, and that they should acknowledge the fact that the United States would never fulfill the terms of the MOU, and that according to the Russians, what Iran needed to do is to prepare for the next war. I should make it very clear that whilst giving that advice, the Russians at no point that I am aware of suggested to the Iranians that they walk away from the MOU and that they attack tankers trying to transit the Strait of Hormuz, and or that they seek to close the Strait of Hormuz again. That has not been at any point Russian advice to Iran. On the contrary, and this one could see from public Russian statements, the Russians have welcomed the ceasefire and the reopening of the Strait of Hormuz. Rather, their advice to Iran was to put aside any illusions that the conflict with the United States was coming to an end, instead to understand that this would be a long drawn out conflict, that there would be another attack on Iran, perhaps as early as the late autumn, when the United States had rebuilt some of its weapons stockpiles, and that Iran would be in for a long duration conflict with the United States, which it needed to prepare for, and that meant that Iran needed to strengthen its diplomatic, commercial, economic, and military links with its BRICS partners, China and Russia. Well, instead, what happened was that the Iranians understood that their leverage was slipping. They understood, they began to realize that a new attack on Iran was coming. And on their own initiative, they decided to reassert their leverage by conducting this strike on this Saudi tanker. So this is what provides the background to what has happened. Now, the question now becomes, what happens next? The United States has been conducting many strikes on Iran, but it conducted many strikes on Iran in March and early April, and these did not cause Iran to break. There's no reason to think that the current strikes will achieve that outcome. So the Americans, again, as I said, are facing the prospect of again having to draw on their strategic oil reserve, which of course remains critically depleted. I've been told that over the period when there was the ceasefire and after the MOU was signed, around 200 million barrels of oil were able to transit the Strait of Hormuz. This amounts to roughly 2 days of global consumption of oil. 60 million of these barrels were Iranian. Mostly they would have gone to India and above all China. The Iranians will have obtained some money from these oil sales, presumably. So in that respect, they have achieved something from the MOU. But from an American point of view, the amount of oil that has transited through the Strait of Hormuz since the signing of the MOU is not enough to shift the dial on the problem of the depletion of the reserves. And so the big question then is, will the United States seek to get the Iranians to come back to the MOU? They will have no shortage of diplomatic allies if they try. India has made it very clear that it wants the Strait of Hormuz fully reopened. So has China. So, of course, have Pakistan. So have the Persian Gulf states. The Iranians will face considerable diplomatic pressure if they reject these demands. And it's going to be, I think, difficult for the Iranian leadership to hold together in the face of this diplomatic pressure. But assuming that they do, what does the United States do? Does it make further concessions to Iran over and above those in the MOU? Does it offer, for example, to close its bases in the Persian Gulf and withdraw all its troops from Iranian ter from the territory of the Persian Gulf states? Does it agree to pay large sums of money to Iran even before the Strait of Hormuz is opened, relying on an Iranian promise to open the Strait of Hormuz? I find it very difficult to believe that the United States would be prepared to make concessions of that kind. Or does it instead choose to escalate itself? And I have to say that the pressure for further military escalation is there and it is growing. I read some posts, for example, by the Fox News commentator Mark Levin, who is very, very much a hardliner in terms of the conflict with Iran. He's widely believed to have been one of the people who persuaded President Trump back in February to commit to Prime Minister Netanyahu's ideas about attacking Iran. Reading Mark Levin's comments, I have to say that to me, they look like preparing the ground for a demand that the United States begin a large-scale ground operation against Iran, something that President Trump has shown extreme reluctance to do, something which I think the Pentagon would want very much to resist, but the political imperatives could conceivably push the United States in that direction. Now, if that's the way things are going, then I have to say that a ground operation is going to take many months to prepare, at the very least. By that point, the petroleum reserves will be critically depleted, or will have long since been politically depleted. We could see increasing signs of economic stress and crisis in the United States, and by the way, in Europe too. So the ground operation would be taking place against that background of economic stress and crisis. And it's difficult to think in advance what the mood in the West would be at that time. I can imagine some people in the West welcoming and supporting the ground operation as the means to free up the movement of oil through the Persian Gulf again, of dealing, as people would say, with Iranian blackmail over the Strait of Hormuz. Of course, Iran itself has been subjected to extreme coercion over many years, which most people, I for one, would describe as blackmail. But people have an extraordinary capacity to forget that and to focus on the coercive measures that others are taking against them, and to forget the coercive measures that they have themselves taken against those people that they're now complaining about, just to say. So I can imagine that in this atmosphere of crisis, there might indeed be some support for a ground operation in the West. Of course, that support might not last for very long if the ground operation starts to fail, if there are very, very heavy losses. But then, of course, we will be in an even more critical situation, a situation indeed of such deep crisis that I don't want to speculate too far ahead of events about what might happen next. Anyway, there we go. That, it seems to me, is where we will be. To repeat, there will be very heavy pressure on Iran to go back to the terms of the MOU. There are some people in Iran who will probably support that in spite of what has happened. But I do get the sense that the people who I will refer to as the hardliners, the people in the IRGC, the people who within the clerical leadership who want to take the toughest line, it does seem to me that they have been strengthened over the last few weeks. American non-compliance with the MOU will have strengthened belief in American duplicity within Iran and about America's inability to follow through with its promises. And above all, the enormous turnout at the funeral of the supreme leader of Iran, Ali Khamenei. As I discussed in my program yesterday, will have given renewed confidence amongst the hardliners in the Iranian leadership that if they are in a long-haul war with the United States, the Iranian people will be with them. That may be a mistaken calculation, but then, as I said in my program yesterday, the enormous numbers of people, tens of millions of people that came to Khamenei's funeral speak for themselves and confirm the extent of support within Iran for the current political system and for the policy of resistance to the United States. So anyway, this is what I get to say about this crisis at the moment. Let me now turn to the other crisis, the crisis in Ukraine. And before I do so, let me say something about the most farcical, the most ludicrous, the most empty, the most preposterous NATO summit of my memory. And many of these NATO summits have indeed in the past been empty and hollow affairs, but none more extraordinary than this one. It lasted for all of 2 days. There was a single plenary meeting and a dinner. One got the sense that the main participant, President Trump, didn't want to be there. He was thinking, obviously, about the Iranian situation. He made little secret of his contempt and fury towards his European partners. There were all the usual hollow commitments about European rearmament and about increasing defence spending in Europe, which President Trump wants. What that is, by the way, all this extra defence spending, what it should be understood as, is not any real programme for European rearmament. Rather, it is payment, tributary payments by colonial vassals to their imperial master. Because a lot of this money is going to go to the, ultimately, to the US military industrial complex, in other words, to the United States, though the middlemen, the European governments, the European officials, well, of course, some of that money is going to stick with them, and a little of it will be recycled amongst the people who pretend to make weapons in Europe. Just saying. So this is what that was all about. Some European reporters perhaps had a glimmer of understanding of the realities. The NATO Secretary General, Mark Rutte, was even questioned about his really ghastly sycophancy towards Donald Trump, his ludicrous civility. And one could see that he was embarrassed by the questions, and as far as I could see, gave no real coherent answer to them. My own view, by the way, is that Rutte almost certainly hates himself for what he's doing. People who behave in this kind of way always do. They're going to be very, very angry, and they're going to take that anger out on others. And of course, in Mark Rutte's case, he's taking out the anger mostly against the Russians, though he will also be taking out a lot of the anger against the various dissidents in Europe. And by the way, on that, we see more action taking place against dissidents in all sorts of European countries, especially in Germany and Britain. I've been hearing reports of some very disturbing prosecutions in Germany, and I've already touched on a very concerning new national security law that is passing through the British Parliament. Much of this is, of course, in fact, mostly it is about the elites in Europe maintaining control, but one should not overlook the sense of anger when people know that they have lost the respect of others, and the Europeans know that they have lost the respect not just of the Americans, but of all the other great powers, China and Russia, and of much of the world. Inevitably, they begin to disrespect themselves. They become angry, and they take out their anger against their own people. This is a well-known phenomenon, and I think we are seeing elements of it play out in Europe today. But anyway, angry or not, the Europeans continue to continue to do these things. And of course, what unites them, what continues to make them happy, is this delirious euphoria that they are all in about the fact that, as they say, as they repeatedly tell each other, Ukraine is actually winning the war. It is winning the war, even as the facts on the ground and in the sky show, on the contrary, that it is losing it at an ever faster speed. It is most extraordinary in most respects, in fact, in nearly all respects. Ukraine's military and overall position has never been worse at any time since the start of the special military operation. It is about to lose Donbass. It's likely to be about to lose Orekhov as well. There is a deepening military crisis in Kharkiv and Sumy regions. It is being pounded by the Russians with strikes that are many times more powerful than those that Ukraine is itself dealing out against the Russians. Its allies in Europe are in deep economic crisis. Germany's economy has been in almost constant recession since the start of the special military operation. Deindustrialization processes are accelerating. Chancellor Merz's popularity levels are plumbing depths that not even the outgoing British Prime Minister Keir Starmer ever saw. Starmer himself, of course, is on his way out. And in spite of that, people are filled with euphoria in the West. They're saying that Ukraine is winning, Russia is losing, Putin is delusional, Putin is isolated, the Russian economy is in crisis. They tell these things to each other and give every appearance of believing them, even though the facts now tell us a different story. To understand how bizarre the situation has become, just consider we now have the Strait of Hormuz closed again. There's likely to be a deepening oil shortage. And yet people in the West cheer on the fact that Ukraine continues to conduct attacks on Russian refineries and the fact that Russia is now importing gasoline, petrol from India and Kazakhstan and Belarus and probably China, something that, by the way, it regularly does. But people are cheering all that on, and they are cheering on the fact that Russia has stopped exports of diesel, which, by the way, it also quite regularly does, especially in the summer at the time of the harvest. This is something that one should be popping open champagne bottles about, even though we face possibly sky-high fuel prices with the Strait of Hormuz closed again, and with particular problems with shortages of diesel and aviation fuel, which, if you want to understand how shortages of those two are related, well, I would suggest go to Larry Johnson's blog, Sonar 21, and he explains it all perfectly there. Yet people, as I said, are euphoric about something which the Russians will be able to get on top of, but which can only make our situation in the West even worse. Even the Biden administration understood that trying to interfere, to attack the Russian energy industry was bad for the US and for the West, Western economies altogether, and pushed back against Ukrainian demands to do it. But today, even though the Biden administration is history, people in Europe cheer it on. And they cheer on the enormous rearmament drive, which is producing no weapons, even as they are obliged to reject Ukrainian demands for more Patriot missile systems to be provided by Europe to Ukraine. We had this extraordinary procession of countries, starting with the Netherlands, all coming forward and saying that they're not in a position to provide Ukraine with any more Patriot missiles because they don't have any. So they don't have air defences, because that's what it amounts to, because the Patriot is the only major air defence system that exists in the West. So they don't have an air defence system, and yet they cheer on Ukrainian strikes against Russia, even as they open themselves up to potential strikes by the Russians against themselves, which they have no effective counter to. I find this also strange and so difficult to understand. To me, you can barely make all of this up. But anyway, that in Europe is what we're apparently determined to do. Well, General Zaluzhny, remember him? The former Ukrainian military chief, who's now Ukraine's ambassador to Britain. He has tried to write a lengthy article in the Daily Telegraph, trying to puncture this sense of euphoria. He said, don't think that Russia is losing the war. And then he explains as carefully as he can, using, it must be said, very qualified language. After all, he is Ukraine's ambassador to Britain. Anyway, Zaluzhny tries to explain why the current sense of euphoria is completely misplaced. But his article was up for a few hours. It then disappeared. At least you can still find it if you search in the Daily Telegraph on their website. But it's no longer the lead article anymore. And, well, things continue exactly as they were. The euphoria still continues. Well, all of this euphoria, even as the Ukrainians lose more positions, it looks like there is now a major crisis developing in Kharkiv region. Beli Kolodis appears to be about to fall. There is a major military crisis in Donbass. Konstantinovka unequivocally has fallen. Liman almost certainly has fallen too. The Russians appear to have captured a lot of territory immediately to the east of Konstantinovka over the last few hours, and the fighting in Dobropilia, which I was a little sceptical about, does indeed appear to be happening. And, well, there's also more reasons to think that a storming operation of the town of Orekhov in Zaporozhye region is about to happen. Now, when I say all of these things, of course, the immediate counter is the fuel shortages that are happening in Russia. There's been another meeting in the Kremlin to discuss the fuel situation. This has been widely reported in the West, but in my opinion, wrongly reported in the West. Briefly, Putin had a meeting about the fuel situation about a week ago, when he discussed it extensively and gave a series of instructions to the Deputy Prime Minister in charge of the energy industry, Alexander Novak, asking him to take the situation under control and to stabilize the fuel situation inside Russia. The meeting that took place yesterday, which has been the subject of much of the current commentary, was a follow-up meeting to that first meeting. The Russian cabinet met to discuss economic and social questions. This was a scheduled meeting. Putin attended, and Putin asked Novak to report about progress in fulfilling his instructions of a week ago. And there were various regional leaders there who also provided information about the situation in their own regions. So it wasn't quite the second emergency meeting that many people believe. Anyway, essentially what Novak said is that since the meeting a week ago, the situation has to some extent stabilized. There's more fuel being evenly distributed through the system. There is no shortage of fuel, either of gasoline or diesel in Russia. Reserves are about the same as they were last year. The refinery attacks have done some disruption, but they've certainly not created a crisis. There has been heavy buying of gasoline in some places, and there's been the long-term problem, which I always read about every year at about this time, that the big oil companies at precisely this time of year tend to hoard gasoline and don't supply enough gasoline to the independent companies that operate most of Russia's gasoline stations. This has been something that has been talked about for at least 15 years. Every year there's discussions about the need to do something about it. Nothing is ever done. The problem, if anything, from year to year appears to get worse. And it's particularly bad in Crimea, where most of the gasoline stations, in fact, all of the gasoline stations, are run by independents because, as nobody in Russia ever wants to admit, the big Russian oil companies, Lukoil and Rosneft and the others, never established their own gas filling station networks in Crimea because they were nervous that if they did so, that would expose them to Western sanctions. So, anyway, none of this is to deny that Ukrainian attacks on refineries do take place and that they do create some disruption. The attack on the giant Omsk refinery will undoubtedly have added to the problem, though I've heard that whatever the damage done was, it's expected that the refinery will be back in full operation again at a maximum within 3 weeks. I expect it will be done much more quickly than that. The ships that were apparently attacked in the Sea of Azov, which were used by the Russians mostly to supply fuel to Crimea, according to the Russians, were empty, and only two ships were hit. The Ukrainians say otherwise. There's lots of video footage. People can look at the video footage and judge for themselves. I am not able to say. Video footage is something I can barely see, so I'm not going to talk about that. But anyway, the point is that these are manageable problems. They cause great inconvenience. They're probably not what you would want to see in the run-up to parliamentary elections in autumn. But according to every report that I've heard, they are not changing the attitudes and perspectives of most people in Ukraine in relation to the people in Russia in relation to the conflict in Ukraine or to anything like that. Well, there it is. The situation, as I said, continues. I believe that we will, at some point, perhaps after the autumn elections, see the Russians upgrade the SMO. I've been told not to suggest that it could be upgraded into an anti-terrorism operation. That was the term Ukraine used in relation to conduct of its military campaign against Donbass in the summer of 2014. And the Russians would not want to use Ukrainian terms for a Russian thing. Counter-terrorism operation is perhaps a more likely term. So I suspect that that is what we're going to see. But in the meantime, the war will grind on. More of Donbass will fall. More of Zaporozhye will fall. And the expectations the West has of a radical change in Russian policy, I predict, are not going to be fulfilled. Well, this is where I finish today's program. Let me remind you again that I'm going to I'm in Montenegro, and I've been apologies for the fact that these are shorter programs. Let me remind you again that you can find all our programs on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble, X, and Substack. You can support our work via Patreon and Subscribestar and by going to our shop. Links under this video. Last but not least, if you've liked this video, please remember to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. That's me for today. More from me tomorrow.